fishy. I'm sorry for killing the fishy. I'm sorry for killing the fishy.
I remember thinking, I would take a bullet for that little girl. Anyway, Agent Reed and I arrived in Martin's Point, and I parked the cruiser near an ice cream parlor on the far end of the main street. The shop owner was also the owner of the F-150 that had been stolen the previous day. Unfortunately, we were one block from the town's sandy beach, where dozens of tourists tanned on any given summer day. The stop for the bus from Stanton was immediately across the street. The large town parking lot was behind us, and anyone walking from their car toward the water would have passed where the truck had been stolen. So this location had hundreds of suspects, and not a security camera anywhere in sight. The store owner's name was Bonnie Butterfield, which I thought was a great name for someone with an ice cream shop. She gave us free ice cream when we introduced ourselves. I'm not too proud to turn down things like that. I picked a flavor called Ursulina Poop, which was chocolate hazelnut ice cream swirled with fudge and studded with nuts and malted milk balls. It was terrific. Agent Reed got vanilla, and I rolled my eyes at him. Bonnie took us outside and showed us where her truck had been parked, half a block from the store itself. It was out of view from inside the parlor. She'd discovered it was missing when her husband arrived at 1 o'clock and mentioned that the truck wasn't in its usual spot. She'd seen it there about 11 o'clock when she went outside to meet the mailman, so the theft had occurred sometime in the 2 hours or so in between. She also told us with some embarrassment that she'd left her truck unlocked with the keys in the cup holder. She'd been doing that for years without any problems. I wasn't surprised because half the families in this area couldn't even find their house keys if you asked, but this time it was Agent Reed who did the eye rolling. After our conversation with Bonnie, we stopped in at every store along the main street to see if anyone had witnessed the theft, but no one had seen a thing. We located the mailman, too, who was no help. There wasn't anything else for us to do. Half an hour later, we were in my cruiser on the way back to Everywhere.
What did you take away from all that?
Reed asked me, as if I were a trainee at Quantico. I thought about it as I drove. Then I said, the time.
That's right. What about it?
The truck was stolen sometime between 11 and 1. The Gruders passed the truck on the National Forest Road around 1:15 or so. And we're at least a 90-minute drive from where we found Jeremiah's bicycle. So if this was our guy, he didn't waste any time. He must have driven straight there.
Exactly, Reed said. Whoever took the truck knew where he was going. He had plans.
Chapter 18. That night in Everywhere, the rain came. After I took Agent Reed back to the command post, he set me free until morning. I drove to the Nowhere Cafe and parked on the main street, where rivers ran through the gutters and the downpour drenched me immediately. It was 10 o'clock. All the shops were closed, and the only light I could see was from the window of the diner. Even so, the street was still crowded with cars bearing out-of-state plates. The cafe was open late to accommodate a full house of strangers. Print and TV reporters, volunteers and curiosity seekers, all sharing posts on Instagram and Facebook. Our little town was suddenly the epicenter of the daily news. Inside, I squeezed to the end of the lunch counter and found an open stool next to Adam. He'd switched out of his uniform into casual clothes. He wore a tight-fitting white t-shirt, ratty blue jeans, and a baseball cap backwards on his head. His brown curls poked out from under the rim. He had a bottle of Bud in front of him and two other empty bottles on the counter. He glanced at me with a resentful stare as I sat down.
Busy day, Shelby?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, it must be nice to be in the middle of all the action.
Come on, Adam. I didn't ask for this.
Yeah, but you got it, didn't you? Maybe if I had perky little tits, Agent Reed would have picked me.
He was trying to get a rise out of me, but I kept my mouth shut rather than fire back at him. I knew he was drunk and didn't know what he was saying.
So did you find Jeremiah?
Adam asked. You know we didn't.
Did you find anything?
We're still looking for the missing truck.
You mean all those feds crawling over town and they still don't have a damn clue what happened? What a shock. It's almost like they don't know this area from the holes in their asses.
Adam, I murmured sharply, keep your voice down. You want these reporters to know you're a cop and you're drunk? If Agent Reed hears about it, you're going to be in big trouble.
Oh, what's he going to do? Give me a crap assignment? You know what I spent my day doing, Shelby, while you were hanging out with the Phoebes? I was visiting campsites on my motorcycle, talking to Bubba and Dixie in their RV about whether they'd seen anything strange, sticking my head inside every outhouse to make sure nobody was hiding there. Reed was very insistent about that. Check every toilet, he said. Supposedly, they found a kid gagged and bound inside a porta potty on one case, but if you ask me, he was making that up. You got a body? You bury it.
Adam, I hissed at him again. Don't talk like that. He went back to his beer.
Whatever.
Breezy arrived to rescue me with a glazed donut, which she knew was my favorite. She'd already put in a 15-hour day, but looked none the worse for wear. She was whistling, and I suspected that the pockets of her apron were stuffed with tips. She'd borrowed new clothes, too. Somewhere during the day, she'd traded her red mock turtleneck for a button-down white blouse sheer enough to give the world a look at the skimpy purple bra she was wearing underneath. Enough buttons were undone that the girls practically spilled out when she leaned over.
Is he still being Mr. Grumples?
Breezy asked, eyeing Adam next to me.
Oh, yeah.
Poor baby, she said, sticking out her tongue at him. The FBI won't let you play with them?
Shut up, Breezy, Adam retorted.
She reached out and patted his hand, and she tugged on her blouse to make sure he had a good view.
Sorry, sweets. I don't mean to poke the bear. Drink up. The next one's on the house. When I'm in a good mood, I figure the world should be too.
I checked my watch. It's late, Breezy. You guys ever going to close?
Maybe at 11. Look at this place. I've made more money today than I'd make in 2 weeks normally. I mean, I feel a little bad about it, but still. No offense to our local boys, but I wouldn't get a 25% tip around here if I served them stark naked. Today? That's my average.
Lots of reporters on expense accounts, huh?
No kidding. I hope this keeps up for a few days. I'll have enough to retire Dudley and get a new car.
Then she closed her eyes in disgust with herself.
Oh my God, did I just say that?
Yeah, you did.
Sorry. I got carried away.
Hey, I get it. Just keep it to yourself. Breezy pasted the flirty smile back on her face and went off to serve the strangers in the diner. I looked toward the front window where rain continued to pour down from the night sky like a deluge. A drum roll of thunder made the building shake. Jeremiah's out there in this, I said quietly, underneath the noise of the cafe. Adam heard me.
Yeah, I know. It sucks.
Do you think he's alive? I leaned close enough that Adam's beer breath was in my face.
If he is, it might be better if he weren't,
Adam replied. Being drunk has a way of making you speak the truth even when you're better off with a lie. I swore because I didn't want Adam to be right, but he probably was. I'd held on to the hope all day that this was a mistake, an accident. But suddenly, there was a truck. The truck changed everything. Someone had gotten into a stolen truck, and 2 hours later, Jeremiah vanished without a trace, leaving his bicycle on the road. I couldn't find an innocent explanation for that. Have you seen my father? I asked.
Yeah, he went home.
What about Monica?
She left an hour ago.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, Shelby.
What?
Sorry for being a dick.
I winked at him. What else is new? I finished my donut and waited for the sugar to kick in, but it never did. I watched the rain, which was hypnotic. Every now and then, lightning flashed over the Carnegie Library across the street like a broken branch. I thought the storm might pass if I waited long enough, but the downpour kept on. Eventually, I climbed off the stool and left money on the counter. I gave Breezy a 30% tip, which didn't amount to more than a dollar. I figured she'd laugh about it anyway. "I'm heading home," I told Adam.
"Yeah, see you in the morning."
I listened to the thunder. "You still got your bike outside?"
"Yeah."
"Well, drive carefully."
"Always."
The rain did finally quit. The roads were a mess, slick with mud and leaves and fallen branches, but at least I could see where I was going as I drove home. When I got there, the lights were on, giving the house a saintly glow through the stained glass windows. Dad's truck was in the driveway, but when I called for him inside, I got no answer. I checked his bedroom, which was empty. The bed didn't have a wrinkle and was made with hospital corners, as always. When I looked through the windows at the backyard, I saw him. He'd built a screened-in gazebo out there years ago as a playhouse for me. The light inside made it look like an oasis in the darkness. I went out the back door and trudged through the muddy grass, leaving footprints. A firefly winked at me near the trees. Inside the gazebo, I found Dad in one of the wicker chairs. He was still in his uniform, sitting straight up with perfect posture. The daily crossword puzzle was folded up in his lap, with only a handful of words filled in, and he had his phone on the table in front of him as if waiting for it to ring. Something told me it hadn't rung all day. "Hi, Dad." He gave me the kind of smile that lets you know in a glance that you're loved.
"Hello, Shelby."
"Mind if I join you?"
"Please."
I sat down next to him. We didn't talk for a while. We just listened to the buzz of insects hiding in the grass. Eventually, he asked about my day, and I gave him an update. We were silent again after that, until he looked over at me and said,
"I owe you an apology, Shelby."
"For what?"
"I should have listened to you about Adrian and the Gruders."
"It was a hunch. I got lucky."
"No, you were observant, and I didn't take you seriously."
"Don't worry about it, Dad," I said, but I liked hearing it. Somewhere during the day, he'd slipped off to see the town barber and get his hair cut. When I looked at him in profile, I could still see his face looking like it did in photographs from 25 years earlier, when his hair and mustache were dark brown. He'd been leaner then, but just as serious. I remembered the proud expression on his face in the first picture Monica had taken when he held me as a baby. It was a long time before I understood what it meant to him to find me on his doorstep in that year of all years. He'd lost his father to Alzheimer's 4 months earlier, his mother to the same damn disease 5 months before that. Enter Shelby Lake into his life. He used to say that I'd saved him as much as he'd saved me.
"I have to ask you something, Shelby."
"Sure, Dad. What?"
"I don't want you to panic when you hear it."
"What is it?" His hand trembled a little with nervousness.
"What's the name of the boy who disappeared?"
I stared at him. "Dad, I don't..."
"Just his name, Shelby. Please."
"It's Jeremiah, Dad. Jeremiah Sloan." He nodded as if it were one of the answers in his crossword puzzle that had eluded him.
"Of course it is. Thank you. I was able to remember everything else about the past 2 days, but not that. Weird, isn't it? It was just gone, like a chip of paint falling off the wall. This has been a bad day. I know it'll go up and down, but this was a bad day."
Dad was being clinical about it to protect me. I knew he would never show me the depth of his frustration, but it was there. I looked away so he wouldn't spot the sadness on my face, but I could never fool him.
"You don't have to pretend, Shelby. We'll just take it as it comes."
"I know."
"It can move fast, or it can move slow.
and there are new drugs now. Hopefully we'll hardly notice it for a while.
I know, I said again, choking on the words. Funny how I could feel myself getting older at that moment. The teenage girl, the volleyball player, was slipping away from me into the distant past and leaving me alone. It was as if Jeremiah had taken what was left of that side of me with him when he disappeared. Trina's sick again, I added, not knowing why I felt the need to tell him that when he had his own troubles. She told me about it last night.
I'm so sorry.
I don't want her to be alone going through this again. I'm just worried she won't open up and let me in. Or anyone else. Not Carl, not Anna.
Some people can't do that.
I know. That's not who she is.
All you can do is be there for her. She has to decide for herself what she needs.
I know, I said again. Sitting there, I felt a wave of anger at the world. It's that helpless frustration we feel when fate deals a blow to someone we love, and there's no one we can blame and no one we can scream at.
Do you want to bring out your guitar?
Dad asked, trying to pull me out of the hole I was in. No, thanks. I'll take a rain check. I want to be by myself for a while.
I understand, Shelby. Go on. Get some sleep.
I stood up and bent down to kiss him on the top of the head. While I was there, I put my arms around him and didn't let go. He held on to me, too. We didn't need to say anything. There was nothing we could do about the future. I turned and left the gazebo and hurried upstairs to my bedroom. When I stood by one of the windows looking down on the backyard, I saw the light of the gazebo go out, and I could just barely make out my father as he returned to the house. With him gone, there was nothing but wilderness outside. I opened the window and breathed in the humid air through the screen. The night was quiet and still after the wild storm, with barely a leaf moving in the trees. Then, out of nowhere, a barn owl swooped down in front of me, its huge auburn wings spread wide. I jumped back with a shout. For an instant, I saw its monk-like face staring at me as it crashed against the second-floor screen, and then after the impact, it spiraled away down to the ground. When I peered out again, I could see the bird on the grass below me, hopping as it tried and failed to fly on a broken wing. I sprinted for the stairs to rescue it. You know me. I believe in signs. That one felt like a bad omen of what was to come. Chapter 19. I do regular transports of injured birds for the Stanton Raptor Center, so I keep heavy cardboard boxes and falconry gloves in a shed near the house. With Dad's help, I was able to get a blanket over the owl and secure him inside a box, which I put on the floor of the front seat of my cruiser. I called my friend Jeannie Samper, who runs the center, and she said she'd be there to meet me. Jeannie was used to calls at all hours during the summer season, and I'd never once seen her fail to get up in the middle of the night to receive an owl, hawk, or eagle in need of help. Stanton is an hour's drive east from everywhere. The highway was dark and empty and still slippery from the heavy rain. There was a lot I could have been thinking about as I drove, but I put it all out of my mind and simply stared down the tunnel of my headlights and kept a watch for deer and moose. I could hear the occasional rustle of the owl shifting inside the box. I made it to the Raptor Center just before midnight. The facility was really just Jeannie's house and a few acres of land, located well outside the busier Walmart section of town. She and her husband and four kids were squeezed onto the upstairs floor, while the downstairs, garage, basement, and outbuildings had been converted into areas to treat and house several dozen birds of prey at any given time. Jeannie was a ruthless fundraiser, and the equipment and care she provided rivaled anything you'd find at a veterinary hospital. The garage was open as I drove up the muddy, twisting driveway through the woods. However, the person who met my car wasn't Jeannie. A man I'd never seen before came up to my door with a smile, and I rolled the window down.
You must be Shelby. Jeannie said you were on your way. I'm Dr. Lucas. I understand you have a little patient for me.
Yes, it's a barn owl that flew into my window. I'm worried he may have a broken wing.
Well, let's get him inside and take a look.
Dr. Lucas didn't look more than 30 years old. He wore a white lab coat over a red-checked flannel shirt and stone-washed jeans. He had long, sandy hair that hung loose to his shoulders. I'd never been much of a fan of long hair on men, but on him it worked. He had a thin frame and narrow face, and his eyes were warm and very blue. When he smiled, the skin around his eyes crinkled and made you want to trace the lines with your finger, as if you were exploring a map of an exotic new place. When I got out of the car, I saw that he was taller than me, but not a giant, only about 5'10". He shook my hand. His grip was firm, and his hands were soft. I took him around to the passenger side, and he reached inside to take the box with the same gentleness you would use with a newborn's cradle. As the box moved, the owl inside got scared and began moving about, and Dr. Lucas murmured,
"It's okay, buddy. We're here to help. Don't worry."
I liked this man. "I'm sorry to get you out of bed in the middle of the night," I told him.
"Oh, I wasn't sleeping. Wide awake and staring at the ceiling. I was actually pleased to get Jeannie's call."
"And you're a vet?" I asked, which sounded like a stupid question as soon as it came out of my mouth.
2 years now,"
he replied with a grin, as he carried the box inside the garage. I followed him past the lineup of glass windows at the back into the treatment room.
"Don't worry. I passed all my tests. I can take a dog's temperature like nobody's business."
I laughed. In fact, I may have blushed a little. "Sorry. What I mean is, I usually see Dr. Tim over here." Dr. Tim was the sweetest, most capable vet on the planet, and about 200 years old. He'd volunteered his time at the Raptor Center ever since Jeannie started it.
"Yes, I recently joined Tim's practice in Stanton," Lucas told me. "He's planning to retire in a couple of years. When he does, I'll take over the business."
"Dr. Tim retire? That's hard to imagine. I was pretty sure they'd have to take him out of the clinic feet first."
"Well, that may still be true. It took me a few months to convince him to let me come on board, and so far all he's done is cut back his hours a bit. But that's okay. When you do something you love, why would you want to quit? Anyway, I'm in no hurry. As far as I'm concerned, he can stay on as long as he likes. I'm just happy to learn the ropes."
There was something refreshing about meeting someone else like me who wasn't in a huge hurry. Sometimes I feel like the world is filled with nothing but Violet Rochas, who rush to finish one day in order to get to the next. "Do you live in Stanton?" I asked.
"I do. I moved here about a year ago. I was actually born around here, but my family moved away when I was 10. I grew up in Kansas City, and then I went to vet school at Kansas State."
"But you moved back here? I don't hear that a lot."
"Oh, it's a complicated family drama. My grandfather needed help, and I was the only one willing to uproot myself to go back home. I guess the fact that I still thought of Stanton as home, even years after we moved away, made me realize it was something I needed to do."
"I know exactly what you mean." I was enjoying my conversation with Dr. Lucas, but I heard a tapping behind me on the row of windows that separated the treatment room from the garage. When I looked over my shoulder, I saw Jeannie Samper waving at me.
"Don't worry, I've got this," Dr. Lucas told me. "You don't have to stay in here. Go talk to Jeannie."
"Are you sure? I'm happy to help. I've done it before. I'm practically a vet tech."
"It's fine. If I need another pair of hands, I'll shout."
I felt the tiniest twinge of disappointment at being dismissed, but I left him alone with the owl. Outside the treatment room, Jeannie greeted me with a hug. I apologized for coming so late, but she waved it off as if it were nothing. The two of us watched Dr. Lucas through the glass as he tended to the owl. You can always tell someone who loves animals. His movements were quick, firm, and tender as he prepared to sedate the bird in order to X-ray its wing. "So Dr. Tim has a partner now," I said. "Amazing!"
Yeah, I never thought I'd see the day,
Jeannie agreed.
I like Lucas. He's very capable and very charming.
He sure seems to be, I said. Jeannie winked at me.
Unmarried, too.
I shrugged off her comment. Jeannie's mission in life was to fix me up. Yeah, well, who has the time?
Uh-huh. You never have time if you don't make time, Shelby Lake. Come on, let me fix you a cup of tea and we can chat.
I had an hour's drive home ahead of me and I was anxious to get back on the road, but I never turned down tea with Jeannie. She grew her own, and her kids sold it at farmers markets during the summer. Once you'd had her tea, you really couldn't drink store-bought anymore. Jeannie led me up an old narrow staircase with boards that creaked and shifted under my feet. In the second-floor family room, I plopped down on her threadbare sofa as she went into the kitchen to boil water. She had a homemade lemon-scented candle burning. That was the only light. The doors to the other upstairs rooms were closed. Everyone else was sleeping. She returned shortly with tea for me in a china mug that looked as if it had been around for decades. The flower design on it was faded. She had her own tea in a ceramic mug with a logo for the Stanton Raptor Center. Nothing matched around here, and that was fine.
Here you go, sweetie.
Jeannie sank into a glider opposite me and pushed herself relentlessly back and forth with one leg on the floor. She was 40 years old, with prematurely silver hair that was tied in a bun behind her head. Having four kids, she always said, was what had turned her gray. She was tall and very heavy, but her weight didn't slow her down. I'd never seen her when she wasn't busy doing three things at once. As she drank her tea, she turned on the television and muted it, fanned herself with a magazine, and fiddled with the baby monitor that let us listen to the noise of her six-month-old, Hildy, in the nursery. Life for Jeannie was a constant juggling act, but she never showed any stress about it. Despite the pressures of running the Raptor Center, she and her husband managed to find time to homeschool all of their kids. Their oldest, Matthew, was 16, as deeply religious as his parents, and had already been accepted to college at Northwestern in the fall. The two middle kids were just as bright.
What an awful thing about Jeremiah Sloan, Jeannie said. Are you any closer to finding him?
Not so far.
If this happened to one of my kids, I think I'd be driving up and down every street in the county shouting their name. Dennis must be a wreck.
He is. They all are.
People are saying that someone grabbed him. Is that true? It's hard to believe around here.
We're not sure what happened yet, I said cautiously.
Well, I have two boys. Don't rule out the possibility that Jeremiah wandered off on his own and got into trouble. That's what boys do.
We're not ruling anything out yet. Jeannie opened her mouth as if to say something more, but then she closed it again. She sipped her tea, and her round face in the flickering glow of the candle looked troubled. She played with a loose strand of her gray hair and pushed back and forth in the glider. Jeannie, is there something else?
Oh, I'm sure it's nothing. I shouldn't say anything. I don't like to be a gossip.
Jeremiah's missing, I said. This is no time to hold something back. Jeannie put down her mug on the coffee table between us. No one could hear us, but she leaned forward in the glider and whispered anyway.
Well, you know I see Dennis a lot. Either he's over here or I'm in the ranger station.
Of course. Dennis's job in the National Forest meant that he was often discovering birds that needed treatment at Jeannie's center. When healthy birds were ready to be re-released into the wild, Jeannie worked with Dennis to do so deep in the forest land. That shared bond had made them good friends over the years.
There was this odd little thing last fall, she went on. It makes me kind of uncomfortable to talk about it. I mean, I know the kind of man Dennis is, and I've made peace with that, but I don't like being recruited as a co-conspirator.
My eyes narrowed with concern. Go on.
I was with him at the ranger station, and he asked if my son Matthew would be willing to babysit for Jeremiah that Saturday night. All night. He was wondering if Matthew could sleep over at his house.
Why didn't he have Adrian do it?
That's the thing. Ellen and Adrian were both out of town. She was off at some retail conference in New Orleans, and Adrian went with her.
Ah, I got the picture.
Yes, you see why it bothered me, right? Dennis was going to be gone all night, and he wanted a babysitter from Stanton, not everywhere. He didn't want the news getting around. I was pretty sure he was having an affair and looking for a way to hide it.
Well, I doubt it's the first time, if you believe the rumors.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. Like I say, I know Dennis, warts and all. I wasn't crazy about it, but I agreed to let Matthew do it. He's been trying to save money to buy a telescope, and Dennis was offering $100 to have him stay over. I knew Matthew could use the cash.
So what happened? I asked.
Well, it seemed to go fine. Matthew and Jeremiah hung out watching TV and playing video games during the evening, and then he got Jeremiah ready for bed around 9:30. No problem. Except I got a call from Matthew at 1 a.m. He was in a panic.
Why?
He went to check on Jeremiah before he went to bed himself. The boy wasn't in his room.
He was gone?
Yes. Matthew was about to call 911, but I told him first to search the house and then walk around the yard to see if he could find the boy anywhere. That's what he did. Matthew found Jeremiah hanging out on the back porch below his bedroom window. He said he'd climbed down to watch the stars.
So what's the problem?
Well, Matthew was pretty sure that Jeremiah was lying. The boy wasn't in his pajamas anymore. He'd changed clothes. And his shoes were all muddy like he'd been off in the woods somewhere. Matthew asked him about it, but the boy swore he hadn't been anywhere. He said he went out in the middle of the lawn and that was that.
But, I asked, because I could tell the story wasn't over.
But Matthew said something else, too. He told me the boy looked really, really scared. I mean, the poor kid was trembling. It was like Jeremiah had seen a monster.
Chapter 20. I slept through my alarm on Sunday morning. Instead of waking up at 5:30, I woke up at 7. My father was already gone. His cruiser wasn't in the driveway. I got ready quickly and then made my usual stop at the Nowhere Cafe for breakfast. Like last night, the tables were filled with out-of-towners. I called out my order to Breezy and took a seat at the counter next to Adam. He was on the same stool he'd been at the previous night, looking as if he'd never left, except for the fact that he was back in his deputy's uniform. His eyes were bloodshot and rimmed with dark circles, his hair was dirty, and he had a pot of coffee and 4 aspirin on the counter in front of him, the universal clues of someone nursing a hangover. "You get the license plate?" I asked.
"What?"
"Of the truck that ran you over."
"Huh. Funny."
I laughed, but Adam didn't. He popped all of the aspirin onto his tongue and washed them down with coffee. "Has my father been in here?"
"Yeah, he already went over to the office."
"I bet he complimented you on your appearance."
"The subject came up," Adam replied.
I laughed again because I could imagine how that conversation had gone. "Well, don't let Agent Reed see you looking like this. He won't be impressed either. He'll send you off to investigate more toilets." Adam's face had the mournful look of a bloodhound.
"Too late."
"Why? Reed's already been in here?"
"No. I did something stupid last night."
I didn't like the sound of that. "Oh, Adam, what did you do?"
"I was pissed off about getting shut out of the investigation, and I was hammered. So I called him."
"You didn't."
"Yeah, I did."
"Did you talk to him?"
"I left a message. It was an epic rant. I'm pretty sure my career is over. What the hell, it's probably better that way. I suck. Everything I touch, I screw up."
I put a hand on his back, because Adam looked as if he might cry. I'd never seen him so upset. "Hey, come on, it happens. Cut yourself some slack, okay? It's been a tough couple of days for all of us, and none of us have gotten much sleep. Besides, you don't report to the FBI. You report to my father." Adam shrugged off my reassurance. He was feeling sorry for himself, and I couldn't really blame him.
If the FBI wants me gone, I'm gone. Reed talks to Violet, Violet talks to Tom, Tom kicks me to the curb. You know that's how it goes.
I'll talk to Agent Reed, I promised him.
It won't do any good.
You don't know that. And no matter what the FBI or Violet says, Dad's not going to fire you for one mistake. He may read you the riot act, but that's all. He knows you're good at the job. Breezy showed up in front of me, bringing coffee and a short stack of blueberry pancakes. She looked as bright as the morning sunshine. Her long hair was washed, her makeup was neatly done, and she had a spring in her step. I wasn't sure if it was the prospect of another day of big tips, or whether she'd gotten lucky last night. Or both.
Adam telling you his tale of woe?
She asked. Yep.
He kept saying he was going to call that FBI guy, and I said, don't do it. I tried to cheer him up, but he wanted to mope instead.
Breezy leaned over the counter until she was practically in Adam's face.
And you know, Adam Twilly, most men like the way I cheer them up.
Knock it off, Breezy, Adam fumed. I'm not in the mood.
I changed the subject before Adam blew up again. So how's Dudley? Back in the land of the living?
Yeah, for the moment. Kenny at the Witch Tree Garage went over to my place yesterday and tinkered with the engine. I was able to get it started this morning. Of course, then I practically ran out of gas on my way in. I thought I had a spare tank in the shed, but no such luck. I was afraid Dudley was going to sputter out before I made it here.
Breezy tended to ramble when she talked, so I tuned her out as I ate my pancakes. I had this strange habit of eating pancakes like the phases of the moon, and my breakfast was waxing gibbous when I heard Adam mutter a curse under his breath. His face looked gray as death. I followed his eyes and saw Agent Reed in the doorway of the diner. The FBI man wore a dark suit and had reflective sunglasses over his eyes. He beckoned me with his finger. Stay put, I murmured to Adam. Don't say anything. I figured we didn't need a confrontation between Adam and Agent Reed in front of a dozen reporters. As it was, questions about the investigation flew as soon as they spotted Reed, but he stood near the door without responding, as if he were stone deaf. I left my pancakes behind, threw some money on the counter, and hurried over to join him. He held the door open for me, and we stood on the sidewalk together outside.
Good morning, Deputy Lake.
Hi. Listen, I hear that Adam left an unfortunate message for you last night, and I just want you to know... He cut me off.
If Deputy Twilly has anything to say, he can say it to me himself. Don't fight his battles for him.
Sure. Of course.
We don't have any time for distractions. There's been a break in the case.
I felt my heart rise into my mouth, giving me a bitter taste. I was afraid of what he would say next. Did you find Jeremiah? Agent Reed shook his head.
No, but we found the missing F-150.
The white truck was in a parking lot near the beach at Shelby Lake. Obviously, this was an area I knew well. I'd spent many hours here throughout my life, looking out at the cove where my father had moored his boat between the trees and thinking about the strange circumstances that had brought him home to rescue me. This was my sacred place, the small lake that had been touched by God. To everyone else in Middle County, of course, it was just a quiet destination for avid fishermen like Dad or Adam, and teenagers looking for a makeout spot where the cops wouldn't find you. Its location wasn't really all that far from Martin's Point, where the truck had been stolen, but it felt remote compared to that busy tourist town. If you'd swiped a truck and wanted to party in a place where no one would find you, this was a good spot. The same was true if you'd kidnapped a child. In the early morning hours, the F-150 was the only vehicle in the parking lot. The truck was wet with leaves and pine needles that had been swept from the trees. The area was paved, so there were no tire tracks. An FBI forensics team surrounded the truck, examining it inside and out. Another team patrolled the beach, hunting for evidence of anyone who had been here, and still another team hunted through the park's garbage cans. At least 20 cops and volunteers were spread out through the surrounding forest on a search for Jeremiah. Who found the truck? I asked Agent Reed.
A fisherman got here at dawn. He remembered the media reports about the F-150 and called it in.
Is there any way to tell how long it's been here? Reed surveyed the parking lot with a frown.
No. Our search grid hadn't covered this area yet, so we don't know when the truck was abandoned. Hopefully someone will come forward and let us know whether they saw it in the parking lot in the last couple of days.
One of the FBI forensic analysts, who was robed completely in white, called Agent Reed over for a conversation. I stared at the F-150 and tried to connect the dots in my head. On Friday morning, this truck had been parked half a block from Bonnie Butterfield's ice cream parlor in Martin's Point. It had been stolen sometime after 11 o'clock, and barely 2 hours later, the Gruders had spotted someone in a white F-150 near the spot where Jeremiah disappeared. Maybe it was this truck. Maybe not. Now it was Sunday morning, and the vehicle from Martin's Point had been found abandoned in an area that was nowhere near the National Forest. Reed returned and peeled off his sunglasses.
There's nothing in the truck.
No evidence that Jeremiah was inside?
No evidence that anyone was inside. It's been wiped down. No fingerprints anywhere, not even inside the flatbed. In your experience, are teenage joyriders that good at covering their tracks?
No.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. Kids didn't do this. It was a thorough job. Someone didn't want us finding anything.
You think this is the truck, don't you? I asked.
Without more evidence, we can't be 100% sure. But if you want to know what my gut tells me, then yes, this is the truck, and yes, it's connected to Jeremiah's disappearance.
What does that mean? Reed studied the searchers in the forest, pushing shoulder to shoulder through the underbrush.
If Jeremiah was inside that truck, then either someone brought him here to the lake after kidnapping him, or someone abandoned the truck here to throw us off the scent and make us search in the wrong place. Either way, I don't like the fact that he's done with it.
I understood the implications. If the kidnapper was done with the truck, then it was possible he was done with Jeremiah, too. Neither of us wanted to say it out loud, but I began to fear that we would never find the boy alive. Sunday was already off to a bad start, and as Agent Reed and I stood near the waters of Shelby Lake, it only got worse. I heard the ping of a text arriving on my phone. It was Monica Constance sending me a message. I checked it, and then gave Reed the news. The police in Stanton have found a body. Chapter 21. No, it wasn't Jeremiah. The body was that of Paul Nadler, the 94-year-old Alzheimer's patient who had wandered away from his nursing home on Friday morning. We'd feared for months that something bad would happen to Mr. Nadler when he made one of his escapes, and something finally did. A river runs through the heart of Stanton. It's not a big river like the Mississippi. It's more of a creek that ebbs and flows with the rainfall. On Friday, when Mr. Nadler disappeared, it would have been a trickle under the Oak Street Bridge. But on Saturday night, the heavy storm would have swelled it into a torrent racing through the land south of town. The Oak Street Bridge was only 4 blocks from Mr. Nadler's nursing home. Anyone sitting under the bridge deck would have been invisible from the street, so it wasn't a surprise that no one had found him. The Stanton police suspected that he'd died down there, and the next day, when the rains came, his body had been picked up by the swollen currents and tumbled downstream. An organic farmer driving into town for the Sunday open-air market had spotted Mr. Nadler's body 2 miles south of town, on the grassy riverbank beside the highway. Nadler was dressed the way he'd been when he wandered away on Friday, in a blue button-down dress shirt, a plaid blazer with patches on the elbows, pleated tan slacks, and natty wingtips he'd probably owned for 30 years. His leather wallet was found still buttoned into his back pocket, and it contained 26 soggy dollars, a frequent buyer punch card from a long-closed Stanton restaurant, and a laminated photograph of his late wife. His face in death was utterly peaceful. The discovery of a dead body so soon after Jeremiah's disappearance triggered Agent Reed's rule that when two unusual things happen in close proximity, it was important to look for connections. As a result, the FBI forensics team took control of the death investigation and was planning to oversee the autopsy. However, there was no sign of foul play and no violence to the body other than the post-mortem injuries of the river currents. To me, it looked as if Mr. Nadler had gone to sleep under the bridge and never awakened. All in all, in the grand scheme of things, it didn't seem like a bad way to leave this world. Even so, it made me sad. I was sad for Mr. Nadler dying alone. I wondered what he remembered of his life when he left, and whether he had any thoughts about his family or friends. Most of all, I was sad because when I looked at the body on the riverbank, I didn't see Mr. Nadler's face. I saw my father's face. I saw my proud, strong father stripped of who he was, unable to pick up a fork and tell you what it was used for. I had a vision of the future, and it filled me with dread. "Do you need me here?" I asked Agent Reed.
"No, not for a while. Do you have somewhere you need to be?"
I thought I would walk the route from the nursing home to the river bridge and see if Mr. Nadler left anything behind.
"Okay, that's a good idea. Come back here when you're done."
But I could tell he knew that this man's death meant more to me on a personal level than I was sharing. I was sure Violet had told him about my father, and it wasn't a big leap from there. I drove alone into the heart of Stanton, past the chain restaurants, past the Walmart. I found the 3-story senior apartment building where Mr. Nadler had lived. It didn't look much different from the outside than a building where 20 and 30-somethings would live. 2 cars from the Stanton Sheriff's Office were in the parking lot, and no doubt they were breaking the bad news to the residents and staff. I parked in front of the building and crossed the street. There was a mailbox, a bus stop, and a McDonald's on the opposite side. One of the times Mr. Nadler had disappeared, he'd been found in the children's playland inside McDonald's, jumping with the kids in the bouncy castle. Oak Street ran next to the McDonald's through a leafy suburban neighborhood. As I walked on the sidewalk, the sun came and went through the trees. Death shouldn't have been stalking such a perfect Sunday morning. Ahead of me, I could see the river bridge. It took me only a few minutes to get there on foot. I walked halfway out onto the bridge, then looked down over the railing at the swift waters below me. In the hours since the rain, the level had already dropped, but it was still a miniature version of whitewater rapids rushing around gentle curves toward the southern end of town. When I looked behind me, I could still see Mr. Nadler's apartment building a few blocks away. I retraced my steps to the riverbank and made my way down the grassy slope, which was wet and slick. A concrete walkway bordered the river, but the water level had risen above it. I peered under the bridge itself, trying to see between the support posts. Staying above the waterline, I sidestepped along the sharp slope of a retaining wall under the bridge deck. I was surprised to find someone sitting there, only inches away from the rushing water. It was Dr. Lucas from the Raptor Center. He hadn't noticed me yet. He was staring at the current as if he were hypnotized. "Well, hello," I said. He looked at me when he heard my voice. I'd startled him, and he had to place me in his memory.
"Oh, hello. It's Shelby, isn't it? This is a surprise."
"Yes, I didn't expect to see you again so soon. How's my owl?"
"I expect it to make a full recovery. The injury to the wing wasn't serious."
"That's good. I'm glad to hear it." He took note of my uniform.
"I'm sorry. Jeannie didn't mention that you were with the police."
"Middle County, not Stanton. There was a body found downriver this morning. I'm here with the FBI to make sure there's no connection to the missing boy from everywhere."
"Yes, I know about the body," Lucas replied.
"Oh?"
"He was my grandfather, Paul Nadler. That's my name, too, Lucas Nadler."
I carefully slid down onto the concrete slope next to him. The river slapped loudly against the stone. It was darker and cooler here in the shadows of the bridge. "I'm so sorry. You mentioned your grandfather last night, but I didn't make the connection, I don't think Jeannie ever mentioned your last name.
Yes, that's the vet world. I'm always Dr. Lucas, never Dr. Nadler. I prefer it that way, to be honest. It's more personal.
Well, I apologize for pulling you away in the middle of a family crisis. I mean, to take care of the owl.
No, I was glad to do it. I needed to think about my work for a while and not about Grandpa Paul. I've been a wreck since Friday, not knowing where he was. At least something like this reminds you how people pitch in to help. The police and the people at the facility have been great. Jeannie, too. The two of us drove all over town looking for him.
I know this didn't end the way you were hoping. All I can say is, I saw his body. There were no signs of distress or pain.
Yes. I was there earlier when the Stanton police called me, and I thought the same thing. He looked as if he'd just slipped away. Still, I wish I'd been with him. The police think he probably came down here to the river from the nursing home, so I figured I'd come here too. I figured maybe his spirit would be hanging around for a while. I suppose that sounds foolish.
No, it doesn't. Lucas smiled at me. I thought the same thing I'd thought last night. He had a nice smile that went from his mouth all the way up into his blue eyes. His long blonde hair was messy across his shoulders.
I came back to Stanton because Grandpa Paul needed help. I was hoping to take care of him myself, but by the time I moved here, it was obvious he needed more care than I could give. That's why I moved him to the facility. It's not a bad place, even though it can be awfully depressing.
We got the reports over and everywhere every time Mr. Nadler wandered away. It seemed like they couldn't keep track of him. Lucas laughed sadly.
Well, don't blame them too much. Grandpa Paul was like Houdini, an escape artist. We tried GPS trackers. He found a way to take them off. The elevators were locked out, but somehow he always managed to slip away from the dining room. The police would call when they found him, and I'd go talk to him wherever he was and take him back there. He hated it. He'd cry when I left. It broke my heart.
It broke my heart, too. If you don't mind a personal question, did he know who you were? I asked. Lucas's face got a faraway look.
Occasionally. Just for a moment or two. Most of the time, no. I was in there somewhere, though. He'd talk about things we did together when I was a kid, but he didn't realize that it was me sitting there with him. Still, I liked hearing the old stories. It was a comfort knowing there were bits and pieces of him that the disease hadn't taken, even if he couldn't connect them to reality anymore. He'd talk about this resort we used to visit during the summers, and for him it was like we'd just been there the previous weekend. Or he'd laugh about the ant farm he built for me and how all the ants got loose and sent my grandmother screaming out of the house. I remember when that happened. I was probably 7 at the time. But he thought the two of them still lived in the old house. He'd ask me over and over where my grandmother was. To him, she was still alive. Still the most beautiful woman he'd ever met.
That's sad. But it's sweet, too.
Well, as I say, it was nice knowing the disease hadn't wiped out everything.
The two of us were quiet for a while. I was comfortable sitting with him. It occurred to me that he was one of the few people I'd met who had been through what was ahead for me. I didn't like talking about it, but Lucas made me feel safe. My father, I murmured. He looked at me.
What about him?
It's starting. Lucas understood immediately.
I'm so sorry, Shelby.
Yeah, thanks.
How old is he?
Only 55. It's early onset. His parents went the same way.
There are things that can be done now to slow it down.
I know. We'll explore everything.
Well, if I can help at all.
I appreciate it. I checked my watch and saw that a lot of time had passed while I was sitting there. I really need to go.
Of course.
I pushed myself to my feet and brushed dirt off the slacks of my uniform. What's next for you? You came home because of your grandfather. Will you leave now that he's gone?
No, I don't think so. I like it here. I always have.
Well, good. And thank you again for taking care of the owl last night.
It was my pleasure.
Goodbye, Dr. Lucas.
Please, let's drop the doctor, okay?
I smiled. Okay, Lucas.
I really am sorry to hear about your father, Shelby. Believe me, I understand what you're going through. If you'd like to talk more, I'm always happy to do that. Maybe we could meet for dinner sometime.
It was a kind, generous offer that also sounded suspiciously like a date. Maybe we could, I replied. I'd like that. Chapter 22. Agent Reed and I had an hour alone as we drove back to Everywhere from Stanton, and I used the time to try to save Adam's job. Yes, I knew he wouldn't lift a finger to help me if the tables were turned, but I didn't want to see him get fired for one stupid mistake. So I talked up Adam as much as I could, and Reed heard me out. Then, without a word, he took his phone from his pocket and played me the voicemail message. It was even worse than Adam had described it. He was obviously so drunk he could hardly talk, and I could hear the beat of the rain and rock music in the background as he tried to form his words. Most of what came out were four-letter obscenities. At some point, the reality of what he was doing must have dawned on him because he cut it off mid-sentence. But the damage was already done. Well, that was bad, I admitted, because there wasn't anything else I could say. Agent Reed didn't react other than to give me a grim little smile. He simply put his phone back in his pocket. I was silent for the rest of the drive. When we reached Everywhere, we went directly to the Sloan house. There was still a crowd of neighbors inside helping the family. Trina was back, and she answered the door and led us into the living room, where Ellen and Dennis were waiting. Reed wanted to give them an update about the F-150 before news broke in the media. I knew the discovery didn't bode well for finding Jeremiah, so when Reed asked to be alone with the Sloanes, I was happy to bow out of the conversation. The three of them went downstairs. Trina and I left the other neighbors in the living room and went upstairs to see Anna, who was hanging out in Jeremiah's bedroom. The door to the boys' room was at the end of the hallway. I headed that way, but Trina stopped me with a hand on my shoulder. We hadn't turned on the light, so her face was in shadow. I didn't see any emotion there, which wasn't unusual. Even so, I knew she had something to say to me. Shelby, we haven't told Anna about the cancer. Not yet. I understand. I just didn't want you to say anything to her. Of course. I won't say a word. But she's a smart kid, Trina. She already knows something's wrong. I know. I'd planned to tell her this weekend, but then, with Jeremiah, she trailed off. Yeah, there's never a good time, I said. No, there's not. Trina took both of my hands. Listen, I have to ask you something. A favor. Anything. Hear me out before you say that. Look, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to beat this again. You know me. I'll fight with every breath I have. But I'm a practical woman. I'm a coach. And being a coach means being prepared for every eventuality, including losing the game. Trina, no, wait, listen to me. You know I don't get sad about things. Life is what it is. I had to deal with all of this the last time it happened. I'm not afraid for myself, but I am afraid for Anna. You know how hard it is not having a mom. I worry about her going down the wrong path because I'm not there. So if the worst does happen, I'd like you to be there for her. I need to know she has someone, not just her father. She needs another woman in her life. You know I will. You don't even have to ask. She squeezed my hands tightly.
Think hard about this, Shelby. I'm not saying be her friend. You're already her friend. This is a very different kind of responsibility, and I know you're likely to have your hands full with Tom.
Don't worry about that. Don't worry about anything except your fight. Focus on what you need to focus on. I'll always be there for Anna. There's never a question about that. If I didn't know Trina as well as I did, I would have sworn that I saw tears in her eyes. She didn't say anything more. With a cracked smile of gratitude, she waved me toward Jeremiah's small bedroom. I walked down there, but Trina stayed in the hallway behind me. I understood that she couldn't go inside. I tapped the door gently with my knuckles to alert Anna that I was coming in. It was a boy's room, painted midnight blue, with posters of dinosaurs taped on the walls. The floor was messy with metal race cars and rainbow-colored Legos scattered around like landmines for bare feet. Jeremiah had dirty underwear and socks piled in the corner, and they had the slightly rancid smell of a boy who didn't shower as often as he should. I saw an open can of yellow Wilson shuttlecocks tipped over on his dresser. It was easy to imagine Jeremiah in the campground, whacking one of those shuttlecocks with his badminton racket and chasing after it. His bed was unmade. He had Jurassic Park sheets twisted into knots. Anna sat on the bed with her legs crossed. She had a pile of rocks and a plastic ice cream bucket in front of her that she was building into a column on top of a hardcover copy of a Rick Reardon book. The rocks were a shiny mixture of flat beach stones, all smooth as if they'd been polished and rounded by water. I pulled a plastic chair over toward the bed and sat down in it. Anna didn't look at me. She kept stacking rocks with a quiet intensity, choosing them carefully so they went one on top of the other. The tower in front of her was almost a foot tall. She had a look about her that said nothing in the world was more important than what she was doing at that moment. "Hey, Anna," I said softly.
"Hey, Shelby."
"What are you doing?"
"This is a Karen."
"A what?"
"A Karen. Last fall, we went on a field trip. The teacher showed us how the Indians made Karens in honor of their ancestors by stacking stones together. Jeremiah and I thought it was cool."
I smiled. "Oh, a cairn. Okay. So why are you making a cairn?" The girl picked up each stone as if it were sacred.
"They're for dead people."
"Are you talking about Jeremiah?"
"Yes."
"Anna, we don't know that Jeremiah is dead. You shouldn't think that. We all hope he's fine and will be back home really soon." Anna placed another rock, and she was careful and precise about it. When she was done, she shook her head.
"No, he's dead."
"Why do you think that?"
"He told me."
I glanced at the open door to the bedroom. I wanted to make sure no one else in the house had come upstairs to hear any of this. "Jeremiah told you he was dead? How did he do that?"
"He came to visit me when I was sleeping last night. He was all wet like he'd been in the rain. He told me that he was dead, but that it was okay and I shouldn't feel bad. But I do. So I told him I would make a cairn for him."
"Anna, that was just a dream."
"No, Shelby. I saw him. He's dead."
She lifted one more stone out of the ice cream bucket and put it on top of the others, but her hand began to shake. This time, the tower of stones fell down over the book and onto the sheets. Anna frowned, and her lower lip trembled, but she didn't cry. She picked up all of the rocks and put them back in the bucket, and then she chose two stones and started over. "In your dream, did Jeremiah tell you what happened to him?"
"No. He didn't talk about that."
"Do you have any idea where he was?"
"In the woods."
"Did you recognize the woods? Was it the National Forest?" Anna shook her head.
"I don't know. It was just somewhere in the woods."
"Did you see anyone else? Was anyone with him?"
"No. He was alone because he was dead. But there was a cross."
"What?"
"A cross. He was standing next to a birch tree and somebody had carved a big cross in the trunk of the tree, like with a knife or something."
You may think I was crazy to ask her about these things, but there were worse places to look for answers than inside a child's dream. Sometimes that's how they share secrets when the real world is too scary for them. And I've always believed that dreams can carry clues, too. No matter what had happened between them, Anna and Jeremiah had been best friends. If he was going to find a way to send a message through anyone, it was her. Thank you for telling me about this, Anna. But how about we keep your dream between us, okay? Can you do that? I think it would upset people to hear you talking about Jeremiah being dead.
I understand.
But it's good that you told me. That's the right thing to do. Remember what I said in the cemetery on Friday? You can tell me anything. It doesn't matter what it is. I'll always protect you no matter what. Anna put down the stone she was holding. She stared into the bucket of rocks, and then she finally looked up. Our eyes met.
No, Shelby. You can't protect me. He's going to get me.
What are you talking about? Who's going to get you?
The Ursulina.
I reached out and stroked her hair. Oh, honey. Oh, is that what you think? Anna, the Ursulina isn't real. It's just a story. You shouldn't believe it, and you shouldn't be scared of it.
No, you're wrong. It's real. It came after Jeremiah, and it got him. And now it's going to come after me next.
Why do you think that? The girl rubbed one of the stones from the bucket between her fingers, but she didn't answer me. Anna?
I can't say anything about that. It's a secret.
A secret? What kind of secret? Anna, I really need you to tell me.
No, I can't. We swore we wouldn't say anything.
My heart started beating a little faster. Was this a secret between you and Jeremiah?
Yes.
Does this secret have anything to do with why you and Jeremiah aren't friends anymore? She bowed her head and nodded. Anna, what happened? Please tell me. But the girl shook her head vigorously and pressed her lips shut. Well, can you tell me when this happened?
It was months ago. I don't know when. The leaves were all over the ground.
The leaves were falling. Autumn. I remembered Jeannie Samper telling me that her son Matthew babysat Jeremiah one night the previous fall, and that Matthew had found Jeremiah sitting out on the deck below his bedroom, terrified by something he'd seen. Anna, I heard that Jeremiah sneaked out of his room one night last fall.